Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Fight Words Network. I'm Don Henderson, and of course, each and every Wednesday night, we come your way. We've got a great show for you this evening. Roy Cummings, of course, in Tampa, as always. I know many of you a little bit of a split program tonight because you'll be watching the Capitals and the Lightning on TBS, which is just starting right now. And Roy will probably talk about that as well as the Bucks, and of course, the Rays get underway with baseball, as everybody does, tomorrow. So a lot of action there. And Daryl Ledbetter will join us from Atlanta with Roger Hemmer, who's also our correspondent in Atlanta, and Mike Zimczak, who's down in the Baltimore and Washington area, and he may have a comment or two about this game as well. He may be at the game. I don't know yet whether he is stationed there or not. But before we start, Frank, let's get a little business out of the way, and then we'll get right into it.
Hi, Don. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, are you tired of paying the high prices on electricity? It keeps going up each and every year, and it's going to go again this year because the legislature just passed another 12%, which they're signing an additional 18%, which make it an additional 30% this year onto your bill. There's a way to stop that by putting biosolar to your house. Solar panels are installed free of charge for you. You sign the contract with BioSolar, and then for the next 25 years, you're guaranteed 50% reduction in cost of electricity. They can be reached at 727-314-6976. Ask for Patrick. He's the owner. And the first 10 callers to call and say they heard it here on Sports Tonight get a $200 cash rebate. So that's 727-314-6976. Yes, it is a Florida number, but they are licensed in each and every state, so they can make make transitions to any kind of, any part of the country that you'd like to have them. Okay, Don.
Okie doke. Thank you very much, Frank. And let's get right to Roy because he's in Atlanta, and he's sort of going to be, I know he's going to be watching the game as he does the show this evening. So, Roy, first of all, baseball tomorrow. A couple of your thoughts about the opening of the season.
Well, thankfully it's here, finally. As Frank and I talked about just before the show started, we were wondering if we were going to get to this day, if we were going to have an opening day, and thankfully we do. And I'll tell you what, I think we are on the brink of some exciting changes in baseball. It's going to be more of those changes are going to come next year. But we're already starting to see one change through the new collective bargaining agreement. You're going to see a lot of young rookies up with their teams from day one this year. And some of the best young prospects in the game. And it's going to be a lot of fun watching some of these kids work their way through the league early on in their careers. You know, we're talking about Bobby Witt Jr., Jose Rodriguez in Seattle. There's probably a dozen of them around the league. And,
I was going to say, you have one right in your backyard. They gave $180 million to an 11-year contract. And what do you have, 70 at-bats last year? And they stepped forward and really put out the money.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of people who think some of the kids coming up this year, you know, right now are going to start their seasons in the next day or two are as good as Willy Adames and Wander Franco. And that you're going to see some really special play out of these guys, and it's so it's exciting. And I think this is again, I think we're on the brink of one of the more exciting eras in baseball. I think we're kind of it may be the dawn of a new era. There's going to be some changes come next year, including pitch counts. They're going to speed up the game. I think we may be getting back to a little bit more base stealing in the game. And I also think, given some of the issues that a lot of teams have with health regarding their pitchers, I think you might end up seeing some teams slowly go back to using starting pitchers the way we all remember them being used, and that's 6-7 innings as opposed to 5-6 innings at best. So we'll see how that goes. That may be a slow-developing trend, but I think that trend may come around. So. Hey, look, I'm always excited about the start of baseball season. To me, it's like another day, it's another like another Christmas day. So, can't wait for it tomorrow. Very excited and anxious to see how it all shakes out.
Well, interesting, and we'll get to Roger in a second. The Yankees announced today, as you mentioned, in the pitching situation with the short spring training, they're only going to carry four extra players for opening day. The rest are all going to be pitchers, and Boone indicated he's going to go very short as far as letting the pitchers go too deep in any games, especially in the first 2 or 3 weeks. Roger, you got Atlanta on your mind. You've got Philadelphia on your mind. You got baseball on your mind. What do you got for us?
Well, I, too, am very happy that the season is getting underway. It's my favorite sport, always has been, always will be. And I just back up what you were saying, Roy. The Phillies announced that Bryson Stott is going to be on the opening day roster. And he was their first pick in 2019. And he had a great spring training, but they even have to make a move to add him to the 40-man roster. And, of course, the teams are going to have expanded roster 28 players, I think, what is it, from May 1st. and which I think is good because of the shortened spring training. But just a lot going on. The Braves, I think, are going to be the elite in the National League East again. They've made some good moves in addition to being the world champions. And, you know, it should be an exciting baseball season, hopefully, now that we've got the labor problems resolved.
Fellas, as was pointed out very emphatically in the New York Post today, in the American League East, along with the Rays, we've got four teams that are in contention to win it and one team that's going to be out of the picture. Obviously, the team that trades right here in Sarasota, which is Baltimore. Right now, they've got the Blue Jays at 92.3 wins the game. They've got the Rays in at 90.3. They've got the Yankees in at the number one spot. They've got them at 92.5. And then, of course, the Orioles are way down. They picked them to win 62 games. They won to the 100 mark they did last year. Maybe they'll get over the 100 mark this year. Roy, it looks like the American League East is going to be a dogfight right down to the last day.
Yeah, what else is new, right? Absolutely. I mean, one of the best teams in baseball last year, the Blue Jays, didn't make the playoffs. You can win 90 games, you can win 90-plus games in that division and not make the playoffs. That's how good it is. And one of those, as you said, one of those teams is going to be the odd man out, and it's really, really intriguing to watch how that's going to play out over the course of the season. And but, you know, it's not just the AL East that's interesting. I think the AL Central is going to be interesting. The Royals have probably the best young prospect in the game in Bobby Witt Jr. coming up. The Tigers look like they want to win now. The White Sox obviously are the cream of the crop, but they've had some injuries that are going to allow some teams to kind of catch up to them a little bit early on, possibly injuries to pitchers. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. And hey, let's not forget about the Twins. They finished last in that division last year, but at the end of the day, they were a much better team than that talent wise. And if they can keep some key guys healthy, they could be a team to watch as well. So I think the AL Central is going to be tight. The West will be interesting anytime you got Shohei Ohtani. Look, we're in an era, guys. You know, Don, you probably got a chance to watch Babe Ruth. I didn't. But, you know, we've got a Babe Ruth-type player in the game right now in Shohei Ohtani. And son of a gun, every time this kid plays, and especially when he pitches, I think it's must-watch TV. You absolutely have to watch it. We're fortunate to have this happening during our lifetime period when we're watching the game. And again, hey, I'm just talking about the American League here, and I think there's lots of stars, and I think the game is again, I just think the game is headed for a bit of a rebound in terms of interest among young fans. I hope so, anyway. It should be.
I agree with that. I also think you have to think of the Angels have two superstars if they can keep their center fielder healthy. A little bit longer period this year. And as you mentioned, the White Sox, everybody was picking the White Sox sort of hands down before spring training started. They had great depth in the pitching staff. They had a great team to put on the field. But as you mentioned, they had some injuries there, which they're going to have to overcome before too long in the early part of the season. Roger?
Well, the one thing, Roy, that you mentioned about the White Sox, and they are the cream. Excuse me. The other thing is, Don, with the Angels, you're right. They got two superstars, and I think the Angels should do very well this year. I mean, and but some of the other moves that have been made, it's just amazing. That what we're going to see. One thing that I like is that now the designated hitter is in both leagues. So I think that's really going to change the National League as far as managing goes. I know it will. I mean, because it changed the American League. So what do you think the effect is going to have on the National League now that we have standardized hitting?
Well, obviously, you're going to see more offense, that's for sure, and you're going to get a chance to see better players, you know, more often. Look, I'm a traditionalist, like I think all of us are.
Yeah.
You know, I like the idea of an ODH, but I got to say that when they had it during the pandemic shortened season 2 years ago, I came to like it. I didn't mind that, you know, another quality hitter was getting a chance to hit during a game, as opposed to watching the hitters, you know, the pitchers hit. And I didn't mind watching pitchers hit. You know, to me it was exciting to see him get a hit. It was frustrating to see him get a hit against your you know, because it's the pitcher and it shouldn't happen, and or you think it shouldn't happen. But I came to enjoy it. I think it's a good move for baseball overall. I like the fact that everybody's playing the same game again. I think that's helpful, and it's going to help. It's going to help teams. You know, it's going to make it a little bit harder, I think, to really gauge who the best teams in the league are. Now, you know, we haven't talked about the NL East, which we should, because Roger, you're in Atlanta. We got a big Philadelphia following here, and you got, you know, let's face it, you got the New York Mets, who I think are kind of like the White Sox in the fact that you got two pitchers at the top of that rotation who are already, you know, battling injuries. One who's going to miss his starts for quite some time, Jacob DeGrom, and then you got Max Scherzer, who I think is going to just tough it out early on here and try to work through a hamstring injury. But, you know, the Mets, I think, were probably considered by a lot of people on paper to be the best team in the division, but I got to say, I think it's wide open again. Roger, what do you think? You're there in Atlanta where the champions rest. They're not the champions that they were just a few months ago, but what do you think about the NL East and how that's going to...
Well, I agree. The Mets have made a lot and spent a lot of money. The Braves put Acuna on the 10-day injured list because he's still recovering from the ACL tear. And but the you know, they had made some great moves early on in figuring that Freddie Freeman was going to leave, which he did, but I still think the Braves are the team to beat until proved otherwise in the NL East, and I think the Mets and the Phillies have a chance to, and probably Marlins, any of them have a chance to make the playoffs with the extended playoffs now.
Well, Roy's correct about the strong pitching for the Mets, because Scherzer, even right up till today, is saying that the hamstring is still a question mark. He did throw a bullpen yesterday, indicating he was, in fact, going to start the opening game. And the other thing is the Mets may get a real surprise, because if the weather's as bad as they're projecting, they may not be on TV for their opening game. And I'm talking in terms of cable TV or home TV. They're going to be on, not Amazon, but what's the other one? I don't know who's ever going to see the game. If it happens on Friday night, they're not going to have their opening game on, which is unbelievable to me.
Well, Apple TV and Amazon.
Apple. That's where it's going to be, on Apple, I think.
Yeah. And there's a lot of – I've read the same thing you have, Don, and I'd like to have Roy's comment about this. I think the worst thing baseball can do is for the money is to put these Friday night games, some really good games, on this Amazon or Apple. And I'll tell you, Chris Russo had a really good commentary about it the other day, and he said he refuses to try to find out where a game is with on Amazon and Apple, because it's so difficult to find it. And I think that's going to definitely affect the fans. What do you think, Roy?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of making it harder to find games on TV. I mean, we're in an era now where with packages like the extra innings package on your cable network and on DirecTV and that kind of thing, where, you know, fans should be able to watch every game they want, and they shouldn't have to go searching for it. It should all be right there for them. If you're paying a premium to watch, you know, any game that you want, you should be able to watch any game you want in one place. And I hope that Major League Baseball kind of figures that one out. I don't have a problem with them cutting a deal with Apple TV and all that. That's, you know, it's great. It's another revenue stream, and they created it. Good for them. A lot of people are obviously Apple TV followers, but at the end of the day, I just think you got to make every game as possible available to the fans who are paying a premium. And I think it's a bit of a it's a bit of a ripoff to me to pay for a premium channel or a premium service and not be able to watch every game, especially some of the battles that we're talking about. We're talking about some of, as you said, Don, some of the best games of the week are going to be could be out. So we'll see how it goes, but never a fan of restricting access to games. It's you used to be a thing. Once you've got something, you can't take it away. Well, now it seems like they might be trying to take some things away from the fans. I don't think it's going to go over too well. We'll see what kind of reaction there is, and it might force some adjustments to it.
I agree with both of you. I think it's absolutely a disgrace that what they're doing. And at the same time, the Yankees, who for all of my lifetime, I'm talking now from when I first started watching baseball, they were on WPIX Channel 11 in New York City. And the Yankees, Mr. Levine keeps telling you how concerned he about is his guests in the ballpark. Doesn't call them ticket buyers. He calls them all the guests. But anyway, they just sold their 21 home TV games to, I'm not sure if it's Apple or Amazon. I think it's Apple. They sold their, so they're no longer going to have home TV. So even if people don't have cable who can see the games on home TV on Channel 11 for 60 years, they're not going to see anything.
Well, PIX got the Mets to cover the loss of baseball. But you're exactly right, Don. Anybody that grew up in the metropolitan or lived in the metropolitan area, you could figure the Yankees, and of course this was before the YES Network, the games
right.
were on PIX 11. And I'll tell you, you're exactly right. There is a tradition in baseball that is gone. And that's another tradition that I think is ridiculous, that the fans do not get to see even 20 games out of 162 or 155, whatever the case might be, on broadcast TV.
The other thing we could touch on, which they just passed today, which I'd like to have both of you comment on, is they did, in fact, install the new electronic system for calling signals to pitchers. So that was approved today. It'll start with opening day. Some of your thoughts on the new sciences of baseball where they're putting in the electronic pitch callers.
Well, I think we adjusted to it in tennis. And I think, to be honest with you, I think people appreciate what we've seen in tennis, where they use a similar system to, make sure that you've got the right call, in or out. So I don't have a problem with it. What I hope is the result is that umpires get a little bit better at calling balls and strikes in the defined strike zone. I think there could be a positive from this. I'm not a big fan of, everything going electronic. I don't like that necessarily. I certainly don't want to see umpires taken out of the game. And we sit here and watch, mechanics decide balls and strikes all the time. But if this forces umpires behind the plate to be a little bit, focus a little bit more, then I'm all in favor of it. And, if that causes some kind of mental anguish or something, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to, changing umpires behind the plate, in midstream. One covers half the game, the other covers the other half if they got to focus more, and that's difficult for them on hot afternoons. I don't know, but I think there's a potential here for this to make the game better and make the umpires better, which I think is what, let's face it, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get, make the calls better. I think this has the potential to do that. And if it does, then I'm not going to be upset about it.
Roger, with your comment, I will say that Washington just scored. They lead the Lightning by a 1-0 count in the first period. So go ahead, Roger.
1-0.
Roger? Did we lose Roger?
No.
I was just on
with Frank. We're trying to hook up with D-Led. And I want to get back to this TV situation. Do you realize, I mean, I know we realize, but we're also older. They just think what made baseball a number of years ago, whether it was the Braves or baseball in general. That's when Ted Turner made TBS the network, okay, or the superstation at first. I mean,
right.
Now it's a network, obviously, TBS, because the old Channel 17 is now Peachtree TV in Atlanta. But look at what it did for the Braves, America's team in baseball. And just because of all those games that any cable subscriber in the country could watch, you got to see all these other teams playing. Roy, don't you agree that helped to make baseball popular in many ways?
Absolutely, no question. I think particularly, there was a whole group here in the Southeast back in the late 70s and 80s that knew about TBS and the Braves. But then when it became a superstation, everybody got it. And, yes, I think it definitely helped. It was a pioneering event. And, I think it was good for baseball. And, obviously I think it was, it became much larger. It was kind of the seed that led to what we have now with extra innings and things like that and all the baseball packages where you can get every team, every team, every game through one package and stuff. And I think what's happened here, guys, with the loss of, stations like WPIX losing the Yankees, a couple of years ago the Cubs no longer on WGN in Chicago, which, again,
yeah.
That was an adjustment.
Correct.
For a guy like me who grew up on that. But I think what's happened is that those local stations just don't have the money to compete with Apple TV or whatever the other, mass marketed website might be. And, it's a matter of making money. And, look, baseball's always been a business, back to the earliest days. The things that we're arguing about now, not necessarily TV, but in terms of, how much they're paying players, things like that, that was an issue back when players were making $100,000. It was an issue back when players were making $10,000. It was an
right.
issue when Babe Ruth played, and it was an issue before that. If you could somehow, pull out a newspaper from the spring of 1904, I promise you, you're going to find some team somewhere complaining about having to pay some guy and can't hold on to him because they can't afford him or whatever. And it's just the way, Major League sports are. But I think, that trying to find new revenue streams is one of the reasons that these teams have, cut ties with the traditional outlets that have carried their games
okay.
for so many years. And it's very sad. It would be nice if those outlets could somehow still carry games, in some form or fashion. That would be nice. I think that would be a nice because, again, let's face it, I mean, it's rare, I suppose. I'm not sure what the numbers are. But not everybody has cable. Not everybody has access to streaming services. So it's a different era, that's for sure.
Roy, one last comment before we let you go, and that is John Cooper and company, they're trailing 1-0 with a little under 13 minutes to go in the first period at Washington. Some of your quick thoughts on the Lightning, where we stand right now as we come down the home stretch.
Yeah, they're going through a little bit of a slump here, clearly, and they're suffering from something that every team and every sport suffers from and every player in every sport suffers from at some point. Even two-time Stanley Cup champion, it's now 2-0 Washington. The Lightning are struggling with confidence. They are playing on their heels. They're just not showing up the way they want to. They can't seem to pull themselves out of it right now. I don't think they're concerned with where they finish in the standings necessarily, because I think they feel like they're still good enough to beat whoever it is that they're going to face, whether they're even if they're an 8 seed and they end up facing Carolina or Florida or something in the playoffs. I don't think they're concerned about that, but they are concerned about their inability at this point to get back to who they were and who they have been for many years. And it's more than just the loss of the three players that made up that dynamic third line for them, because right now none of their scorers are scoring. Their goaltender at times looks rather adequate at best, and sometimes
that's tonight.
The defense.
That's tonight,
yeah.
Roy. He had nobody in front of him, no screens, and when they scored the second goal, so as you said, drop behind 2-0, and you just don't see Vasilevskiy miss those kind of rejection, those kind of shots.
No, you don't. And right now, as you said, about halfway through, Washington's outshot Tampa 6-1, and two goals are in. So it's bad goaltending. It's an inability to kind of. I mean, they got in essence skated out of their own building the other night by Montreal. Now Montreal is playing, without any pressure at all. They're trying to, make sure they all have jobs next year. Playing for a new coach who's excited. They're in a building where the coach is numbers in the rafters, and Marty St. Louis. They had a lot to play for in that game, but Tampa shouldn't be losing to teams like Montreal at home. That should not be happening. But right now, 2-1 Tampa. They just got one from Kucherov on a bad turnover from. So maybe that'll give them a spark. But that's what they need. They need a spark, because right now they are really suffering from a lack of confidence and just not playing their style.
Well, as you mentioned, 2-1 now is the lady did get on the board. And old Roy, as always, whether it's baseball, football, we didn't even get to the Bucks or anything going on there. But thank you very much. As always, the first half hour, always great from Tampa.
Always great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. We'll do
hey,
it again
Roy,
next
have
week.
A great week. Can't
Thank
wait to talk about
you guys.
The Bucks.
Happy
and
opening
their
day to everybody.
Yeah, you too.
All right, let's go
Can't
from
wait.
Tampa, Florida. Let's go from Tampa, Florida to Washington, D.C. And Mike Zinkoff is with us right now. And Mike, first of all, I don't know if you're at the game tonight. Are you at the Washington Lightning game?
No, I'm not at the Lightning game tonight.
Any comment?
I understand what Roy's saying about about Tampa Bay and their struggles right now, but I have full faith in Washington Capitals' ability to make this a competitive game, even if they are up 2-1.
Well, it's interesting to see what, as Roy indicated, what's happening with the Lightning. And, they were a little bit of a slump coming down the home stretch, getting ready to play in the playoffs, and you don't really expect that. You thought they'd slump off a little bit, and then the last, five or six games of the season, they've really come on again like they did to win the Stanley Cup 2 years in a row. What else is happening in the Washington, D.C. area we should touch on?
Well, we can still talk about the Caps. I mean, they're pretty much locked in now to the second of the wild card positions in the NHL, which would see them most likely play the Florida Panthers in the first round. The Caps have struggled with injuries. Their top scorers, Adam Mantha, TJ Oshie, have missed more games than they've played this season. They've suffered from some inconsistent goaltending at best, and their power play has just been, inept, both scoring on it and defending against shorthanded goals or, full-strength goals that happen immediately after a shorthanded situation. So if it wasn't for the heroics of Alex Ovechkin this season, posting what could be another 50-goal season for him at age 36, they'd be in much, much, much worse shape. So it's going to be a tough one for them when they get into the playoffs. I just don't think that they have the speed and the consistency right now to make it through winning the, 12 games necessary to win the Stanley Cup again. And you got to look at them and say, all right, at what point do we make a decision like we're going to have to rebuild, we're going to have to trade, we're going to have to bite the bullet, or, do they eventually get to a situation where they have to let Ovechkin go, which would be a crime because I know they've always wanted him to play his entire career here and set any records that he's going to set at the Capitol, but give him the opportunity to go to another team and compete for a second Stanley Cup, because for him to be, you know, he's arguably amongst the five greatest hockey players, certainly amongst the three or four greatest scorers ever. But when you look at his resume and you see the one Stanley Cup, you start to wonder, like, you know, what happened?
Roger? Well, let's talk, stay with hockey and about the Flyers. I mean, look at the disastrous season they had. They're going to have a new coach. The general manager's on the fence. And do you follow the Flyers still, Mike, since you're from the area?
I still follow the Flyers. I love the Flyers. It was a season that, you know, you came in with a bunch of hope that it was a relative. They had some pieces in there, and you thought that this would be a team that got good, and it just never really worked for them. And they had some really disastrous stretches at points in the season. I think, what, they didn't win a game between October and, like, January?
Yeah,
so
something like that.
Tough to compete. I think the best thing that you can say about the Flyers' season right now is they'll get a chance to – they got – a pretty nice haul, as much as they could, from the from the Claude Giroux move, and you know they can restock their farm system, and hopefully under the right leadership, they can use these pieces, put it together, and start to field a contending team in the next couple of years, because the NHL wants Philly to be as successful as possible, right? You know, they may not be one of the original six teams, but they're a historic franchise. Philly's a great hockey market. And I'm sure that the NHL would prefer that the Flyers were competitive as opposed to a situation where they've got this year where the Flyers, and let's not forget Montreal, the defending, if you will, Eastern Conference champions, are both well out of playoff contention, and we've still got a month left to play.
Mike Zimczak, our guest, as always, in one segment during the course of our Wednesday night program, and he's down in the Washington, D.C. area, Baltimore, Washington, and I think this is going to be a little bit ahead of your time, but in my particular case, one of my mentors for the NBA and a guy that I had such great respect for passed away yesterday at 90 years of age, Gene Shue, and he won 784 games in total as the head basketball coach for the Baltimore Bullets and the Washington franchise. And also with the 76ers, he took the Bullets to a finals, but did not win. He took the 76ers to a finals and did not win, both in 71 and 77. And just a great, great guy. But I think he's a little before your time down in that Washington-Baltimore area, isn't he, Mike?
Well, yeah, he predates me in this area. One, because I'm not that old. Number two, I just moved down here about 10 years ago, so I wasn't really paying attention to the Washington franchise much before that to cover them. So, but I do know that, you know, he is one of the coaches one of the most important coaches of that franchise, and you are correct when you comment on what he meant to them, and you know his passing has been discussed here and what he meant to the franchise, and it's a franchise that hasn't either in Baltimore or DC made it to a lot of NBA finals. I think they've only got the one NBA championship under Wes Unseld in the 70s, so Gene is an important coach for this franchise.
Mike, are you familiar with the late, great Dave Zinkoff, the longtime Warriors and Sixers PA announcer?
No, that's a name that I'm not familiar with, I'll admit.
Okay, well, you've been to the Wells Fargo Center, and you know Zinkoff Drive is right there.
Yes.
Well, Dave Zinkoff was probably the best NBA PA announcer in history, at least my opinion, and he had some great descriptions when players would score. And for Gene Shue, it was two for Shue. And then going back further, you had with the with the Sixers, with Wilt, you had the Dipper, okay, the Big Dipper. And then you had for Jack George on those old Warriors teams, By George. So you had all these different expressions that he developed. And I know Frank's familiar with them. Don's familiar with them. And Don did the Sixers. Dave was still doing the PA, right, Don?
Oh, absolutely right. And Gene was just a terrific guy. We traveled all over the country with him. And he lost the most difficult final we were at there in Portland, as everybody will remember. And Darryl Dawkins got into that little fight at the end of the Sixers. Looked like they were going to roll and win it, and they wound up losing in six because of the regrouping of Portland after the fight with Darryl Dawkins. And so Gene lost his second chance to get an NBA championship. Played five great years with the Detroit Pistons. He was an all-star. He was an all-star coach, an all-star guy, one of the nicest people you'd ever want to be with. And so I just wanted to take a moment or two to remember Gene Shue, who was such a great guy.
Oh, he was. You know, Mike, let's go to hockey if we can. I wanted to just discuss the Philadelphia Union, undefeated, 4-0, leading the league, so to speak, their division. And the Atlanta United, 3-1. The question I have is about Charlotte. We seem to think that Charlotte would follow the United in their development, but obviously it doesn't appear that way, does it?
Well, to be honest, you're right. Philadelphia is sitting atop the Eastern Conference standings. Remember, they're on a four-game winning streak. They did draw their first game of the season. But they're on a four-game winning streak, and they're just playing some incredible stuff right now. Charlotte's gotten off to they've won two, but they've lost four. It is hard in MLS to accomplish what Atlanta United. You have to have a great organization from top to bottom, and we spoke about at length when they came into the league just how much money Arthur Blank was able to invest and willing to invest in the infrastructure that enabled them to be successful. He went right off the bat, got Carlos Bocanegra, the former U.S. men's national team captain and legendary player for this team, installed him as the president, allowed him to set up a fantastic scouting department, which uncovered some really great South American talent that had been otherwise overlooked in the form of Jose Martinez and Miguel Almiron, right? And they were able to use that to just come out of the blocks, and that core of that team just come out of the blocks and be competitive from day one. Well, the rest of the league took note and started doing similar things. That made it harder for them to for a new team to have that sort of advantage that Atlanta did, despite the fact that Charlotte has now set the attendance record for a single game in Bank of America Stadium. I'm sure it won't be long before Atlanta United gets that back, by the way. But I don't know that they've had the financial investment, that their ownership group has the financial capital to make the sort of moves that Arthur Blank made when he was building this team. So they've come in with, without the same level of talent that Atlanta United did, and they're going through growing pains. We saw that with the last couple of MLS teams that came in the form of Cincinnati and Minnesota. You know, both teams struggled a little bit in their first couple of years, and that's more the archetype for an expansion franchise in MLS, or, you know, just in general. You know, not every team is going to be Atlanta United, or not every team is going to be LAFC, where they're going to just be able to come in with the financial backing, such a strong infrastructure, scouting network in place, and be able to sign some of these players that nobody else finds. The other thing about it is the margins, as we've talked about, are very, very thin. In MLS, you can buy a player, you can get a player, and for whatever reason, he just doesn't work out, and things go south, and you just don't perform as well as you would like to. I talked about this with regards to the Union, how, you know, sometimes they've made signings and off-season additions who just haven't worked out, and the parts haven't fit together, and you end up with a subpar season. Now, fortunately, over the last, you know, I would say 3 years, everything's worked out perfectly, and they have become one of the better franchises in MLS. And the onus is going to be on Jim Curtin this year. They've gotten off to a fantastic start. They're playing great. Andre Blake has reestablished himself as probably the best goalkeeper in MLS. Their defense is giving up next to nothing. They're scoring goals, and their big offensive signing, Michael Urre, has just started to get in the form and start and become a starter for the team. So we look and say, you know, at least through this, the Union are in a really, really good position. But this is going to be one of those years where they have set the expectations at the beginning of the season that they need to be in the playoffs and competing for a championship. And winning a trophy has been an issue for Philadelphia in the past.
Mike, what about on the international scene? What's happening of interest there? A lot of soccer being played. What can we talk about tonight?
Well, let's start with this. The draw for the World Cup was on Friday, and we know pretty much for the most part most of the teams that are going to be playing in the World Cup. There were a couple of placeholder teams.
Let me interrupt, Mike, just to say Washington scored again and now leads 3-1. Go ahead with 4:30 to go in the first period.
So the World Cup draw was on Friday, and we know most of the teams. There were a couple of placeholders for playoff spots that will be conducted in June, but we know the bulk of the 32 teams and the groups were drawn. The U.S. finds themselves in Group B for the World Cup, where we will have England, the Iran, and the winner of the European playoff, which right now in June, the Ukraine will play Scotland in Scotland. This was originally supposed to be played this month or in March in the Ukraine, but due to the war, clearly it can't be played there. And then the winner of that game will face Wales. So the U.S. can face one of Wales, Ukraine, or Scotland. At first look, it looks like a group where the U.S. can be competitive and hope to get out into the knockout stages. England's going to be tough. They are a team that made the semifinals of the World Cup in Russia, and they were the beaten finalists in the Euros last year. Iran does have some quality players, and that game is going to bring up a lot of images of 1998 when the U.S. was favored in France to be amongst the competitors for the title and ended up finishing dead last. And one of the games that we lost was to Iran in our second game. We lost that 2-1. That was the only goal we actually scored the entire 1998 World Cup tournament. And then Wales, Scotland, or Ukraine, all of whom are going to be tough for the U.S. to beat, but beatable. So I think, you know, it's still a long way off. We don't know who exactly is going to be playing, who's going to be hurt, what the team composition is going to look like. But it could have been a whole lot worse for the U.S. As far as the other teams in the
Good, Robert. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say, as far as the other teams in this region, Canada finds themselves in a really interesting group where they'll have Belgium, Morocco, and Croatia. Croatia, the beaten finalists in Russia. Belgium, who has been one of the top teams in the world for a long time, but kind of underperformed. Morocco has some really good players, but they're not exactly the most fancied side. I actually think Canada is a dark horse to look for, and I wouldn't be surprised if Alphonso Davies, the Canadian player, ends up being one of the players of the tournament. Mexico finds themselves in a group with Poland and Argentina, so it'll be really interesting to see how they hold up that group.
Mike Zimczak, our special guest, as always, that he's a soccer expert, not only on the local front, but obviously the international scene as well, has seen more and witnessed more games probably than any of us together, all together. Roger, you're up.
Well, I was just going to say, looking at the hockey game, Caps are up 3-1 now. You know, Mike, I was thinking about this, watching the game, thinking about you. The beautiful Capital Center in Landover, Maryland. Is the building still there?
No, that's been demolished.
Oh, what's there now? You know?
I'm not even 100% sure. Probably some sort of mixed-use shopping center.
Okay. Because I'll tell you, I used to love to go to the Capital Center. And it was just, to me, one of the nicest arenas that I had ever been in. And this goes back, obviously, to the late 70s, early 80s. And, pretty new there. But it was amazing the people you would see. And as I recall, Larry King was there a lot. And among others.
Oh, he went to all the games there, Roger.
He did, and
He was a giant sports fan. He went to the games everywhere, whether they were football, baseball, basketball. And you're right. He went to the Cap Center all the time.
All the time, and then he'd go and do his show on Mutual. But I always remember one of his great stories about with Sandy Koufax, because they were buddies. And the group of guys went all the way to Connecticut to go to a Carvel. Do you remember that story, Don? I know Mike's too young.
I sure do.
It was one of the great stories about what they did. They went all the way to Connecticut to get ice cream from Brooklyn. And,
let me interrupt Roger to say the Lightning have now scored again. It's now 3-2 with 3:24 to go in the first period.
Yeah, and the Phillies beat the Rays today in their final preseason game.
They killed them.
9-2, right?
Yeah, they killed them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Phillies had the Phillies have had a halfway decent preseason.
Well, they have. And it's going to be interesting to see how they do and if the pitching holds up. We talked to Roy about it. But did I hear something today that the Redskins, not the Redskins, the Commodores, are going to go to a 3-4 defense? Did you hear that, Mike, or not?
I hadn't checked in on them, so I hadn't heard that. Given that they're very set up for a 4-3, it would a little bit surprise me if they were to do that. But it wouldn't surprise me too much. Right now, though, they traded away Matt Ioannidis, so they have Daron Payne and Jonathan Allen. So my question would be, if you're going to go to a 4-3, who's going to be the extra down lineman, and then where do you see them playing? Where do you anticipate playing Montez Sweat and Chase Young when he returns? And one of the weaknesses of that team, of that defense, has been middle linebacker. So if they're going to go to a 4-3 or a 3-4, I wonder where they're going to get a middle linebacker, which is just not to say that they wouldn't do it. Wonder if they have the personnel and the coach to do it.
Well, yeah.
What are they projections for the draft?
their projections for the draft right now are all over the place. And the big question is going to be when they get to the number 12 pick, which the Commanders have, is one of the quarterbacks there, and do they like him? This is a team that has any number of holes to fill. They need a wide receiver to complement Terry McLaurin. They're going to need some reinforcements on the defensive line, or I'm sorry, the offensive line, because Brandon Scherff went and Eric Flowers was cut. So, you know, they need some help on the offensive line. Linebacker was an issue. They drafted Jamin Davis last year in the first round, thinking he was going to be the answer at middle linebacker, only to find out that he was probably a better outside linebacker than a middle linebacker. The secondary, they need help. Again, they let Landon Collins go. They did retain Bobby McClain, but they're going to need cornerbacks. This is a team that has any number of needs. So they could go in a lot of directions. I think their strategy is going to be to look at, you know, who is the best player available at a position of need that we have and go in that direction. I, unlike a lot of people, am not sold that Carson Wentz deal means that they won't take a quarterback in the first round. I don't know that they're necessarily looking there, but if one of the highly rated guys falls to number 12 and they have an opportunity to take, say, a Malik Willis out of Liberty, knowing that right now there is not a major commitment beyond this year to Carson Wentz, I could really see them going quarterback and saying, you know, at least we know we have this guy in the building, and worst case scenario, we can trade him on later on down the road and recoup some of the picks.
Well, how about the coach, though? He had 2 years to war. He had 2 years where he had sort of a free ride. I would think now it's going to be at a point where Washington's going to have to make a decision. Are they going to? And also, secondarily, they had another front office problem again. More difficulty with harassment of people in the front office this last week.
Well, okay, so off the field, yes, it continues to be a mess. There's another allegation of harassment, and then over the weekend,
right,
on Saturday, it also broke that there was an ongoing issue with them under-reporting ticket revenue to the NFL.
Correct.
Now, the team has come out and said that the reports are false, and anybody who says that is committing perjury, but I heard the gentleman who wrote the report saying, look, we're not basing this report on just personal testimony of the one front office official. There are documents that go along with this that demonstrate what we're saying. So we're going to stand by our report. It's going to come out that they may or may that there may be some financial irregularities in the amount of revenue that they've been reporting. Now, I don't know how related this is to what they report to the NFL, but Jason Wright,
let me just interrupt to say that it's now 4-2 Washington as the first period comes to an end. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm thinking this one's going to be like that Toronto game that ends up 10-11 by the end of it. At the rate that these guys teams are scoring, doesn't look like much defense is being played right now. Anyway, I don't know how much is related to this report of what revenue they're showing to the NFL. I do know that Jason Wright, the president of football operations, has said that they started finally correctly reporting publicly the ticket sales. So they've gotten off this idea that they had a 30-year waiting list and over-reporting ticket sales publicly. So that's at least what they're putting out in the press. Hasn't jived for a long time with what we're seeing. We know that there are a lot of empty seats and a lot of tickets on the secondary market. And for at least the past 2 years, very often away fans have outnumbered home fans at FedEx Field. And you still, even then, are at maybe 5/8, 5/7 full, you know, 50,000 in a 75,000 seat arena. So you're not, you're what, 2/3 full. So it'll be interesting. Again, you know, Congress also investigating these things. Off the field, Roger Goodell naming the Commanders in one of his remarks as a franchise that, you know, they've had some issues with. So it's going to be interesting to see how this develops and if it continues to develop, because we all know that, you know, Congress goes in a different direction in November. By January, these investigations haven't been settled by January, they could all just disappear.
Hey, Mike.
Well, they took a goal off the boards down there in Washington. It's still back to 3-2 again. Roger, go ahead.
I
got a question for Mike.
Go for it,
Mike. There's six state attorneys have filed this morning against the Washington Capitals. They're doing a total investigation on the sexual harassment and of both male, female, and other problems. How does that affect the people down in Washington? Are they looking at that or not?
It's hard. At this point, every new thing that comes out, everybody's just like, all right, and. It was very telling a couple of weeks ago, about a week ago, maybe two. They changed broadcast partners, and they announced on the radio show, the morning show, that the AM station that had been carrying their games pretty much forever, the Fan, WFAN, was no longer going to be doing it. And the natural reaction was, oh, yeah, yet another corporate sponsor that dropped the Redskins, when it was actually the Skins that dropped them. They got a better offer for their radio media broadcast, so they took it, all right? Those things happen. People have almost become numb to the off-field situations, but it does affect certainly the perception of the team, its ability to attract investment, its ability to have its choice of where to move. We've talked at length on this show about the stadium issue, and we saw where Virginia right now has put up a serious package in three sites, none of which are particularly near the D.C. metropolitan, none of which are particularly near the area, right? We're talking probably well over an hour in good traffic to get out to these areas from certain parts of the region. But that's the most likely, because Virginia is the only place that wants them. Maryland said no. And D.C., where they should be playing, they said, you know, we're not going to deal with them as long as we have these issues to deal with. We also see it on the field. One of the reasons why they made the trade for Carson Wentz that they made, and everybody agrees that they overpaid to get him, was because they didn't feel as though they could attract players. They can't get free agents. Mm-hmm. Agents keep talking about the fact, like, you see all the off-the-field news, all the turmoil, all the investigations. This is not a franchise that's stable enough that you want to play for. So they're playing what we call the bad franchise tax. They're having to overpay for players, and they had to make this trade for Carson Wentz, who was probably going to get released, just so they could be assured that they actually had a starting quarterback, because they didn't feel confident that they could attract a quarterback or any players otherwise.
Roger?
Well, getting back to their radio situation, that does make sense. They probably went to
They haven't announced who it was that they went with. The Odyssey, who had the rights, has both an FM and an AM station.
Okay.
So if it had been like that, but what Odyssey said was they had a monetary value that they were willing to pay, and Washington wanted more than that, and so they said, no, we're not going to do this. And the Commander said, okay. I can understand, you know, radio broadcasts aren't worth as much as they used to be. You know, people don't tend to listen to games as much on the radio as they used to.
No question.
There have been issues with the various stations and the Redskins over coverage. You know, the stations feeling like they want the ability to have more access to players and coaches and personnel, and also at the same time have the right to criticize the team when they feel
right.
like they deserve it. And the Commander saying, you know, if you're going to be our flagship station, if you're going to carry our games, you should cover not only the games but the teams the way that we want you to.
Right. Yeah, that's what I had heard. And, of course, TEM used to be owned by Dan Snyder when he had Red Zebra Broadcasting. And he had
yes.
a number of stations, including TEM. And for those of us old enough, like Frank Don and I, TEM 980 was a legendary station, one
mm-hmm.
of the original NBC-owned stations, WRC-AM. And just to give you an idea, some of the people, they had the Joy Boys at night, which was Ed Walker and Willard Scott, the legendary Willard Scott. And, I mean, it was just a great station back in its day. But I think what, like you said, Odyssey was not going to put up with having to be controlled on content about the rest, about the Commodores.
Well,
yeah,
I'll tell you something about one thing about radio and television. I didn't bring this up earlier, but Timmy McGarver announced his retirement. He did not work during the COVID last year in St. Louis. He was doing the color on a number of St. Louis games. He went back there after years, and of course, where he first started his baseball career. And he announced this week that this would. He was going to officially retire from baseball. He was not going to be involved in this year. And so mixing that with the radio broadcast you're talking about, Roger and Mike, when KMOX gives up baseball, and that's when we're going to have to turn in our badges, because they're the last desperate of what we remember as growing up with kids. KMOX had everything.
That's right. Everything is right, and the Cardinals did sign Albert Pujols for his final year, and Molina's going to retire after this year, so they're going to go out together. But I'll tell you, Don, Larry Anderson's only going to do 40 Phillies games, 40 home games, and they had him on the morning show on WIP today. But as I said to you the other day. And Frank, Mike, you'll love this. Bob Uecker, 88 years old, still going strong, doing the Brewers.
Young fella.
Young fella, right.
I did not know that Bob Uecker was still around.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he is. He had never left the... You know, the Brewer, he's been there for almost forever since he retired from playing and being in broadcasting. And as Roger and I talked about earlier this week, the shows that he did with Johnny Carson and everybody else on national TV, and he made that seat up at the top of the stadium famous. That was where they always put him, Roger, right?
That's right. Miller Lite, best seat in the house.
Every time I think of Bob Uecker, though, I think of a line from Major League, high and just a bit outside.
Well, I'll tell you, I was telling Don this story, Mike and Frank, that when I was traveling and doing training years ago, I would do my weekly show on the road if I was on the road, and I'd have the Gentner with me and a mic and headset and everything. And I was at Fenway Park on a Friday night, and I had asked Bob Starr, who did the Cardinals games, the Angels, the Red Sox, and he was doing the Red Sox. And back in the early 70s, he was the sports director at WBZ-TV. And I met him only one time. But Bob Uecker was there because the Brewers were playing. So I had asked both of them if they would come when I was doing the show, 6:05 to 7. The game didn't start till 7:30. So Bob Starr came. We had a nice conversation, and Bob Uecker was very apprehensive about coming. He didn't know me from Adam. But when he saw that I had Bob Starr, he came. And I got to tell you, I shut up. They just went back and forth. I told Don a story. One of the great lines was Bob Starr said to Uecker, "Hey, Bob, I guess you were in St. Louis for the 100th anniversary of Cardinals baseball." "Oh, yeah, Bob, I was. But the cab driver took me to this Spruce and Goose. There's no ballpark there." And he says, "Well, yeah, but that's the old Sportsman's Park site. Did he take you to Busch Stadium?" "Well, yeah, but there was like a statue there of me, but it had the wrong number on it." He said, "What number was that, 6? And he says, "Yeah, that's Stan Musial." And this thing went on and on. It was just, I mean, it was wonderful. And just two guys, you know, and Bob Starr would set Bob Uecker up. And I mean, there was nothing I could do but just go back and forth with the microphone and keep my mouth shut.
I'll tell you the best story I have on Bob Uecker when he was with the Phillies. And this is years ago, of course, at Connie Mack Stadium. And the Phillies dressed, they came out. And Bob Uecker was there, and the bus is there to take him back. And he goes, gets in the bus, and Bob Uecker drives away. nobody knew where the bus was. Nobody knew how the players were going to get back to the hotel. And Uecker just took the bus and drove away with it.
Oh, I'll tell you what, and he's got some books out too. I'll tell you what a life. But I give him a lot of credit because I was going to call in this morning and say to Larry Innocent, "You got some nerve of saying you're retiring when you're doing 40 games when a guy 88 years old's doing like almost a whole season."
Yeah, and he was a lot like Vince Scully in the fact that he did a lot of it alone. And,
yeah.
A couple other things we could throw into tonight's show that we haven't talked about is that LeBron James is going to miss the playoffs for the first time in a long time. The Lakers were eliminated last night, and I'll tell you, I still haven't understood why the Lakers have been on so many ties this year because they're a terrible team, and they lose most of the time, and yet the big, most of the time you see them at the either 10 o'clock tonight or you see him on Saturday or Sunday. And I guess just because LeBron James is there is the reason they're putting the games on because I can't imagine my wildest dreams you want to follow the Lakers.
It's a combination of the fact that it's the Lakers and it's LeBron James. If it wasn't for that, you know, let's be honest, the Lakers are one of the biggest name franchises in the NBA. They're certainly the name franchise on the West Coast. They have a massive following. And LeBron James, of course, is one of the biggest brands in the NBA. So it doesn't surprise me that they're on it. And whether, you know, there are two types of people in the world. There are the people who love the Lakers and the people who hate them. So it doesn't matter. You're always going to get viewers because you're going to get people who want to see them win. And then you're going to get the people who hate them who want to see them lose.
Yeah, the Warriors took a little bit of their luster when Curry came in and became such a dynamic player. And when Kerr took over as the coach and they put those back-to-back championship seasons together. And a big controversy, well, I should say controversy, the big discussion a month or so ago was, is LeBron going to leave the Lakers and not play next year with the Lakers? And he sort of let that hang up in the air for a week or two and then, he said, "Absolutely not. I'm the Los Angeles Lakers next year. I'm not going anywhere."
We've heard him say that before. Until Penn is put to dotted line, I don't believe anything. Because I still remember a TV show from over a decade ago where he announced that he was taking his talents to South Beach. So until he puts his pen to paper and signs, I don't know. And even if he does, it's only going to be a two-year deal. It's not going to be anything long-term. Hey, guys, before I go, I know Doug's coming up in just a minute. I do want to bring up one thing. I was at a ceremony on Monday where my wife, Sonia, was named Dietitian of the Year for the state of Maryland.
Oh, congratulations to her and you. That's
very
fantastic.
Good, very good.
Yes, great job.
So I just wanted to bring that up and congratulate her. She's done a lot.
Well, I'm very, very happy you did bring it up. Congratulations. And number two, I'm glad we didn't interrupt your dinner tonight. It was very nice that we had that chance to chat with you and go over so many different topics.
Yeah. Well, Mike, what restaurant were you eating at last week?
We were down at Laver 2 on Passyunk in South Philly.
Okay.
I don't know
we
if you've
know
ever been there.
Go ahead.
All right, we're going back to Baltimore again. We're going to leave Mike, and we're going to go to
Mike,
our great friend, Doug
right,
Hamilton,
Tom,
is ready to go. And Doug, the biggest week in golf is underway. They're hoping for a little bit better weather. I don't know if you've been watching. If you're working at the club, and I know you don't get a chance to see as much as we do on the Golf Channel, but it looks like the first couple of days are going to be a little bit shaky. But a lot of difference of opinion about who's going to win, and also the major discussion, obviously, about Tiger.
Yeah, I mean, he's always front and center when you talk about golf. And
35,000 there to see him play Monday. 35,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, five-time green jacket winner, you know, biggest draw in sports. I mean, there's no Phil Mickelson there this week, and you know, he was there, and that was all the circulation of discussion whether he was going to play or not, or whether he was there just to, you know, be with his son, play some practice rounds, maybe do the par three or be a part of the champions dinner, you know. But he says he feels good enough to play, so you know, let the betting odds begin.
You know, if you
well,
go
it's
on
it's interesting the, because the top has changed. You know, you look at Rahm, you think, well, Rahm's going to carry on as on top for maybe 4 or 5 or 6 months at least. But it's not turning out that way. There's a different top every month and a half.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, they've made quite a few changes to the grounds in terms of the. You know, they were talking about the 15th hole in the Golf Channel the other night and how they, you know, moved it back some 20, 30 yards and how,
right.
You know, even if you hit a really good tee ball now, you're going to have a, you know, a more difficult second shot into a relatively easy par five, but a choice to make because it's over the water. They've changed some other different holes around to, you know, what I didn't know is that a lot of the proceeds from the Masters that goes to Augusta, whether it's, I mean, I think that the concessions of merchandise and those, you know, tents and food and stuff, that goes to the club. But there's some other exclusive, whether it's the TV money they make or whatever. But apparently Augusta National has to put that back into the actual club itself. They have to spend that money. And it's like, you know, I mean, what do you do with how many millions of dollars on a yearly basis when it comes to, okay, you have to spend this. So whether it's, you know, doing different things to the golf course or the grounds or the buildings or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's all paid for. So they have play money to toy around with when it comes to saying, okay, well, you know, gosh, we don't like these trees the way they are. We're going to fix these, or we're going to put new turf down here, or we're going to do the driving range, or, you know, whatever. You know, that's a pretty nice budget.
Well, they give a lot to charity, too. Okay, and you know, I always was a fan of Billy Payne, who was the chairman for many years, and he was the chairman of the Olympic Organizing Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, I've always enjoyed their app because today there was one of the many pictures is Sergio Garcia with his wife and kids walking the first hole. And the kids are running around. And what's interesting is all of the family have the white what do they call them?
What's
like
the caddy jumper.
Yeah, well, we used to call them like lube suits, you know, for lubrications in the petroleum industry. But I just thought that was great. And then Tom Watson's going to be what the honorary open it up. And but
sure.
they do a great job. And but I'll tell you, Doug, have you ever been there to
yes.
the Augusta National?
I've been there one time. You know, it's a trek to get there with traffic. And, you know, once you're there, you know, parking is always its own, you know, journey. And then, you know, once you get inside, I mean, I can technically go any year I want to. The PGA of America, my membership card allows me entrance into, I don't even have to go to the general gates. I get to go to my own special, you know, area where they make you sign your name and write your member number, and, you know, they give you all these, you know, do's and don'ts in terms of how to act and what you can and can't do, and, you know, the transferable, non-transferable, rather, nature of the ticket. So, you know, when you get on the grounds, I mean, it's incredibly beautiful, and the television doesn't do it any justice with elevation changes or undulations or things that you can see on TV, but you don't really appreciate until you're there in person. I mean, I can tell you that I went, the year I went, I saw like the last maybe two holes, Tiger played with Mark O'Meara, his buddy. And when they teed off on 18, it is so dark. You can't see that on TV, but it is so dark on that 18th tee box. I mean, you could literally develop film there. You know what I mean? It is tighter than a mouse's eardrum when you hit it off of that tee box because of those trees that overhang. And on the right and left, I mean, that's quite a daunting tee shot, very much so.
Well, it's a beautiful jewel in the middle of a not-so-nice neighborhood. I mean,
well, that's true, but Roger, to that point, some of your most incredible golf, I mean, Pine Valley is another good example, although I've never been there. I've heard stories, but Augusta, there's probably countless examples of you're basically driving down the, I don't even know what you would call it, but podunk or downtrodden or whatever areas, and then all of a sudden, you know, the seas part, and it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. And a lot of your best golf courses have that. You know, they're like that.
Well, they spend a lot of money outside of the golf course itself, too, because, as you mentioned, parking was almost non-existent, you know, because
sure.
it was in the neighborhood and so forth. But now they've taken over a lot of that
yeah.
property and ripped it down and put parking lots
yep.
in now. And the other
That's
thing
correct.
I'd like to bring up, which is, to me, almost unfathomable in this day and age. You go in and buy a soda or a shirt or a hamburger, you know, they don't charge you $8, $9. You know?
Right.
They charge you a little or almost nothing for the, you know,
well,
if you're there. The,
yes,
incredible.
And
well, yeah, they
the
really keep the they keep all the concessions at moderate
everything.
Prices that everybody can afford. And I'll tell you, on the app, in the section from the press, boy, if this doesn't bring back memories, it looks like a Quonset hut, and it's got the entire, there's a table or desk after desk, and what it is, it's a teletype machine in front of every reporter, male or female. Now, tell me how far many years that goes back, teletype machines.
Forever.
Forever, it's like.
Doug, you were there. You've seen it on TV many times. One of the things you pointed out, which go back over, and that is the fact that they weren't concerned about Tigers being able to strike the ball and play efficiently, even though he had the accident. What they were concerned about is because of the architecture of the golf course itself, the hills and valleys, that's what they were concerned about. Could he actually 4 days walk 18 holes
yeah.
over those kinds of conditions?
Well, you know, I've made mention of this before on the show that, you know, some of your, you know, we'll call them better golf courses, but we'll call them with caddy golf courses. I mean, there's a local course here in the Baltimore area that's of the national, you know, status. They have local members, but a lot of their membership is from all over the country that fly in and, you know, stay the weekend in their cottages and do their things there. And so, you know, playing there, I played there on a Saturday and a Monday, and I developed plantar fasciitis as a result of walking on what I deem to be non-flat or level surfaces where you feel like your feet are always at an angle or on the side of a hill or in a depression or what have you. And, again, over the course of time that I've been on the show, I've talked about this. I mean, do people look at a lot of these professional golfers as, you know, less than in terms of, I wouldn't necessarily call them, I don't know if you want to call them an athlete or not, but they clearly fall into that category. Some of them don't resemble that with body type, but, you know, to walk, I mean, most golf courses that you walk are going to be somewhere between 4 and 6 miles for 18 holes. And you do that 4 days in a row and obviously throw into the however many swings they're making plus the different things that they're doing beforehand and the practice regimen and the feet, you know, the walking and the pressure and those sorts of things. I mean, you're talking about the potential of walking in excess of 20 miles for 4 days if you make that cut, plus. So, you know, in Tiger's case, obviously, they showed him today, and they were breaking down his swing over the course of the last several years. And, you know, it was his Stanford buddy, his name eludes me, Nota Begay, was talking about, you know, the differences in some of his swing. And I kind of watched him hit a few shots. And to me, it's, you know, it's the same Tiger swing, but it's not quite. His right side where he hurt his leg is just not allowing him to kind of push and be as aggressive as he used to be. So it'll be interesting to see, to your point, Don, how he gets around the golf course from, you know, a physical standpoint of cardio and pain management, if that's a problem, but also how that affects as he plays day one, day two, if he makes the cut day three, into some of those back nines where he might struggle a little bit, you know, with the movement of his body.
Well, as I say, he spent a lot of time last night on the Golf Channel. I was surprised that he hung in there as long as he did answering questions about, you know, what his routine is of getting up in the morning and the team that he has working with him to get him physically ready to go out and practice. And then what happens when he comes in and the team goes back to work, they get him back ready to play the next day. But as you indicate, I think he's going to have a very, very tough time. You know, as you say, when you start walking that far and you're not accustomed to it, I think it's – but I loved his answer. When he asked about that, he come to win. I came to win.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to say a couple things. When Doug, you were talking about, you know, his regimen, getting up and everything. First of all, they tee off at 8 o'clock. That's the first two. And then Woods is with Osterhausen and Neiman at 10:34. Then when you go all the way down to the last trio to tee off, it's Fitzpatrick, Kopra, and McIlroy. That's at 2:03. So you're talking about 6 hours and 3 minutes later from when they have the initial tee off tomorrow. That's a lot of
golf. Also, Roger, it also sets them up for the second day. They talked about this at the 10:23. You know, puts them in the best position to come back and play the next day, and time to get physically ready to go. So
I agree with that, because if they had him early on, like Couples is in the early 8:33, Spahn at 8 o'clock. You know, Mize, a number of them, you know, are Singh, you know, is at 8:44. So I think they really, and Swafford's at 8:55. I think they really did him a favor to help him with his pace for that first day.
Well, I think historically they've put we'll say some of the elder champions first off on the first day. I don't know whether that's, you know, for any other reason other than, you know, look, you know, I mean, some of those guys aren't going to win the Masters. You know, they've won the Masters, but they're not going to win the Masters. You know, technology is so good nowadays with regard to all these different, you know, devices, and they probably take their trainers or chiropractors or all these different people in terms of, you know, the training room to get them ready for treatment and, you know, whatever. I mean, he's got his regimen down pat with regard to how he gets himself ready from a pain management standpoint. It's not like he doesn't know what he's getting into. I think it's just a question of, A, the severity of it, which might be unknown, but I think that's also going to be a function of what the weather's going to be like. I think that, you know, I don't know whether the people earlier or later are going to have the benefit, you know, you're talking about the weather.
Well, tomorrow's supposed to be rainy and 20-mile-an-hour winds. So that's,
right.
You know, hopefully by 10 o'clock, they say it may, you know, may be through, but they're expecting rain and 20-mile-an-hour winds throughout most of the first day and into the second day.
Well, I can tell you yesterday was brutal, and we had rain today, and it's supposed to continue because they've been doing bulletins tonight on TV about the weather here.
Yeah. Well, they postponed the opening day for the Nats tomorrow. It was a 3 o'clock game. They moved it to 7. So.
Well, you know, Doug, what's interesting is on the first one teeing off tomorrow is Elijah Ball, okay? And, I didn't know much about him because, you know, you forget about it, but he won in 94 and 99, and he's 56 years old.
Sure. Well, that's, you know, as I mentioned, typically the, it's not like, I mean, the Masters – you know, as they say, is a tradition unlike any other. I mean, they use the same pin placements, you know, every year, same day one, same day two, same day three, same day four. And their tee time pairings, I mean, again, they're going to put, you know, some of their past champions, you know, that don't necessarily have a chance to win all first. And that's what they've always done, you know.
And also the fact that, if you're in your, let's say, Justin Johnson, for instance, right? Now, his for average 18 hole strokes has gone up to 2 strokes over the last 6 months or a year. He won in 20, but they're saying he's going to have a very, very tough time winning this year because the differential between what he was playing in 2020 and what he's playing today, his best finish was third in the couples last week. But he's that's amazing when you think about how they calculate all this, where he's at a 2-stroke deficit to where he was.
Yeah, I mean, look, the odds makers in any sport are very good at what they do. But we've talked about, you know, to me there's two main factors of the Masters. Number one, I mean, you have to look at the people that are going into this week that are playing very well. You know, and those, you know, the conditions, again, are going to dictate some of that. But, you know, the green complexes and the short game and the putting and all those things, I think, are very significant in the Masters. You know, obviously, to be a major champion, you have to be a good ball striker. But, the Masters itself, I mean, it's the only venue of a major championship that's played on the same golf course every year. And so these guys, you know, historically, I mean, look, Tiger Woods has won it 5 times. I mean, you know, does he have an advantage there because he knows how to play that golf course really better than anybody in the field, you know? And there are people like that we've seen over the course of time that, you know, Mark O'Meara shouldn't have won the Masters, you know, the year he won it. I mean, look at some of the other guys that you would look at that say, okay, well, you know, how in the heck did he win the Masters? Well, he's played well there forever, you know, and, you know, people would probably tell you that Jordan Spieth has a chance to win the Masters this year, you know, because he's won.
I think he does. For two reasons. I think he does because he knows how to shape the ball. When you're there, you know, you got to be able to shape the ball and get it on the right part of the green so that it's to your advantage when you have to make that first putt.
Sure.
And takes time to learn. They're just going back to your statement. Go ahead.
I would say as a PGA professional, looking at the face value of Jordan Spieth, he doesn't have any better chance to win there this year than Fred Couples does. Only from the sense that he has made some significant swing changes. When's the last time Jordan Spieth won a tournament?
A year ago.
You know, so I don't think he's playing particularly well. I mean, I don't know if he goes to bed tonight and something happens and wakes up tomorrow and says, oh, well, you know, holy crap, I'm playing, you know, Augusta National. I've won here before, so now everything's going to, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, Jose Maria, Larry Mize, I mean, all these guys have won there before, you know, but they're probably not, I mean, they're not going to have a chance to win there. I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, I like, you know, from an odds standpoint, I mean, they're a couple of guys.
What do you like, Smith?
I like Smith. I like Victor Hovland.
I like Hovland a lot. I think he's a 20-1. He's a pretty good bet.
Well, and I tell you this, it's been known pretty much on tour that Tiger Woods is a tough guy to get. Like John Rahm had said something about Tiger Woods. He had tried to approach him and ask him some different questions about how he plays different shots or the Masters or these different things, and he doesn't give him any help. But apparently Justin Thomas is like Tiger's protege. He really spends a lot of time with him, and he plays his practice rounds with him, if you notice. And,
right.
You know, if you look at any of the, you know, like whether it's the President's Cup, Ryder Cup, like those sorts of things, like he spends a lot of time with him. And I think, you know, he's invested a lot of his knowledge, which is, you know, worth $1 million to Justin Thomas, who's already he's an incredible player already. So, I mean, I like Justin Thomas, but again, I like Victor Hovland, like Cam Smith. I mean, Morikawa's been pretty good. You know, I don't know. I mean, those would be some of the ones I would look at, you know.
Well, I think Justin Thomas is –
gentlemen, I'm going to give you some history. I just researched the 1973 man. The reason is – I think I mentioned before, you know, not that night, but I was flying from Columbia, South Carolina to New York. We had to go through Augusta to Atlanta. And Pat Summerall got on. He was up in first class. Everybody else was in coach. And that was delayed because of weather, okay? This is the 73 Masters. Tommy Aaron was only major title he ever won. And he was one stroke ahead of J.C. Snead. Now, here's the thing that really got me that I had no idea. Gary Player played in 52 Masters from 57 to 2009 and only missed one, and that was 1973. Isn't that amazing? 52 Masters.
That's crazy.
Roger, you never can tell, Roger. You never can tell.
You know?
Well, I think it's interesting that Tommy Aaron, that was the only major he ever won, was that one master.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, in a little more than 4 years, I'll be 52, and there's nothing that I can sit here and say to you that I've done for 52 years consecutively except for breathe. I mean, how can you play in 52 Masters? That's crazy.
It is. 1957 to 2009. And ironically, he only missed that one in 73 because he had a leg and abdominal surgery. That's amazing. And then in 74... He won the second of his three jackets the following year. He came back, and that's when he won the second of three. Gary Player, I'll tell you, he's a some golfer.
Oh. Biggest disappointment when he lost that British Open a few years ago. He had that, and he was on the 18th hole, and he had that one putt, and just didn't put it in and wound up losing it. But what a great, what a great spokesman for the game. What a gentleman. What a great guy. You're exactly right. He's one of the class of the field.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're going to put Doug in, see how he makes out down there.
You know what? We didn't talk about it all, and while we still have Doug, about that great championship game on Monday night in the Superdome. I mean, I'll tell you what. Don, did you go to bed at halftime like you said you were if it was a lousy game?
No. I stayed for the whole game. I was talking to my son at halftime. I said, and I agree with Smith. He said, there's no way they can lose this game unless they turn the ball over. They turned it over five times in the first half, and they turned it over five times in the first 10 minutes of the second half to take them right down the drain.
Wasn't that amazing how Kansas came back down 15 and turned it around? I thought it was over with. It was unbelievable. Well, I give Self a lot of credit for that.
Listen, the bigger story is, I don't know if this is true or not, but they're saying that Bill Self is likely to walk away from the Kansas program. I don't know what you guys have heard about that.
I have not.
Well, just to walk away and retire or go someplace
else?
I
think he's 59, and they were talking about some potential allegations against the Kansas program with regard to violations, and they were saying that Bill Self was going to, I would guess right off into the sunset as a result of that. I don't know if that's true or not true.
Well, the guy
Kansas hasn't been above. Kansas hasn't been above board for. If you go back to Will Chamberlain, they've had their moments where they paid out a lot of money.
I was going to say the bigger story here is the actual research into collegiate athletics with regard to recruits and the boosters, and I mean, are these, there's countless examples, whether it's, Cam Newton or any of these guys. I mean, why are people choosing to go to these specific universities? And, is there an actual flow of money that's suggesting that they're going there for that reason? Or, Reggie Bush, I mean, look at some of these, they're giving stuff to their parents, houses, money, whatever it is.
Right.
How dirty is college sports, and how brave would someone be to delve into that to figure out the answer to it?
Well, I'll tell you,
they've got the answer, but they don't want to publicize it.
Were talking about this the other day, Doug. Okay, the guy from St. Peter's Holloway, he's going to Seton Hall. Three of his best players from St. Peter's have already gone into the transfer portal, so they will be playing at Seton Hall. Okay. Big East Conference. Then just today, I got the announcement that the Xavier coach is now coming to Georgia State, and they had won their conference. I think it's the Sun Belt. The coach at Georgia State, I think, is. I read that he's went to SMU, and but I was shocked that the coach. From Xavier, who I think just won the NIT title, is coming to Georgia State. To me, that's a step down, okay, to come from Xavier to Georgia State. However, the guy is from Atlanta. Now it makes sense.
I was going to say, sure. I mean,
that's
there has to be some logical tie into his family.
The biggest thing we didn't touch on tonight so far in any of our conversations with everybody around the country is, how about Notre Dame? Tennessee State, and they're going to be the opening game for Notre Dame, the first all-black college and Notre Dame has put them on the schedule for the first game. So that's a pretty big story. And George from Philadelphia originally, Roger, is the coach there, I believe.
Could be.
I think we even honored him at the Philadelphia Sports Writers a number of years ago.
But Don, in my opinion, that's some of the stuff that's wrong with college football in general. I mean, why is Notre Dame playing against that school who has little to no chance. I mean, that's a cupcake for them. And look, I understand the dollars behind it because collegiate sports is a business. I get that. But, you know, this is one of the reasons why we can't correctly determine a national championship, because we play too many cupcake games on our schedule instead of playing, you know, conference games or all these different things to make it fair across the board to say everyone's going to play this many games and we're going to do, you know, an 8-team playoff instead of, you know, this other BS of 4 teams or whatever that we're going to do. So, you know, that's part of the reason why it's not right, you know, in my opinion, you know.
Well, as Nick Vitale says, the cupcakes, everybody, whether it's basketball or football, and for years Temple was part of that cupcake crowd, because we got, when I was working there and doing the games, they would get $500,000 to go to Birmingham and play Alabama. They'd get $500,000 to go to Penn State, or they'd give 2-for-1. Penn State, they had a little bit better deal because they'd give 2-for-1. And that was the only way the football program existed. That's the only way they had enough money to pay for the next season.
Well, and it wasn't only covering football. It probably covered a lot of the athletic program, because the state did not want to foot the bill for the three state schools, Pittsburgh, Penn State, and Temple. Temple is by far the weakest link. Wouldn't you say, Don?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. The weakest. And unfortunately, if it hadn't been for Dr. Lee, of course, who has since passed away, I mean, you know, the Lee Corse Center would not be there. Temple would still be playing out in the hinterlands there at Temple Stadium rather than playing
West
at, well, at that time it wasn't it was the Vet. They played, moved to the Vet first. And let's face it, it's not advantageous. If you're a college student, it's not advantageous for your football team to play in a stadium like the Vet. It's never gone over and never going to go over. But they don't have the money to build a stadium. They don't have the facilities to build a stadium. So the only way they can do it is by, you know, gerrymandering the schedule so that they get the money.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, you know, the other thing is, I know a lot of students that go from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, but I doubt whether there's a lot of students from Pittsburgh going to Temple University.
I would agree with that.
It's more of a commuter school. I mean, it was 90% commuter when I was there, you know, which is a long time ago. But they've increased the dormitory space. But, you know, when we were talking about the basketball team, I mean, they're having problems drawing, you know, and getting good talent to that program. I mean, John Chaney was successful, and Fran Dunphy, you know, had some. But, you know, you get very concerned that it's ever going to be back where it was a tremendous basketball program like it was when I was in high school. I mean, when they came in third in the country, because when they had the NCAA tournament then, the losers played the consolation game. And they had lost to Kentucky and Vern Hatton, and then they won the consolation game. But that's when you had Guy Rogers, Bill Pickles Kennedy, Tink
Hal
Van
Lear.
Patton.
Hal Lear was the best backcourt in the country. Hal Lear and Guy Rogers.
Yeah, and you had Jay Pappy Norman, you know, on that team. Mel Brodsky. I mean, you know, these were great players. And, you know, but I was surprised about the Georgia State, because that program has really grown. And I was there for the very first football game that they ever played. And Bill Curry, thank God they got him. He really got the program started. The Hall of Famer. And what's really interesting is that now the old Turner Field is the athletic stadium for Georgia State. It's where they have soccer, football, everything is in the old. And that was the original Olympic Stadium that they had designed and were able to convert to baseball. So it's amazing.
Well, Dr. Lee, of course, and all the people surrounding him at that particular time. because he was very, very interested in athletics. He was the one that really put the Lee Corps Center on the map. You know, they always played, you know, in a really mediocre facility prior to that on campus. And, you know, you don't have that kind of drive. Dr. Lee, of course, wanted a great basketball team. You got John Chaney in there. John was able to recruit something that nobody's been able to do since, really. You know, you wish all the luck in the world to the president's staff, but so far they're struggling. And it is very, very difficult. As you said, most people don't realize it. You talk about the student body, but, you know, 60, 70% of them are day students. They come in and out. And,
Don, before we get the hook here, I'd like to take just a second, wish my dad a happy early 80th birthday. His birthday is tomorrow. So I know he's listening. I just wish him a happy
birthday to him, and that'll get us right out the door on time. Thank you very much, Doug. Once again, look forward to the Masters this weekend. We'll talk about it next weekend. Roger, always a pleasure, and thanks to our guests earlier.
Before we break, I want to send out my birthday wishes to my uncle, Edgar Hendler, lives in Lansdale with my Aunt Faith. Today, he is 95 years young.
God bless him. God bless him.
So,
Frank, close us out, Frank.
Have a great week. God bless.
Well, there's one thing I want to ask both of you before you leave. After a long career with LaSalle College as a player and as a coach, Fran Dupfy is now stepping back in at the age of 73 years old. What do you think?
Frank, I got to tell you, I called that shot with Don yesterday. Is Don still there? Or did Don leave? I got to tell you, they were talking about it on the morning show that Phil Martelli or Fran Dunphy was going to be back at coaching at LaSalle. And I said, it's going to be Dunph because I just heard him interviewed and he misses the locker room.
And
there it is. So, well, take care, Frank. God bless.
All right, take care. All right, thanks, Roger. Ladies and gentlemen, this program is brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of police and fire services. When you're out there and see somebody in a uniform, please acknowledge them. Let them know you know they're there. It's very, very important that they know that they have your backing at this point in time. These programs are dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffy Polk, Sergeant Thomas Baker, Patrolman Jeffy Azowitz, Sergeant Ricky Childers, Detective Randy Bell, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Condon, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Chris Lake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Arthur Chris with Lisbon TV, Lieutenant Joe Serber, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Laterna, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Art Hook, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Pikus, Wilmington Fire Department, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Chief Al Hogel, Wilmington Chief Police Department, and Chief Jerry Ford, Wilmington Fire Department. My brothers and sisters are letting me be 10-7 at this point in time. At some time, they will be born. Until that time, may the roads rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the hollow of his hands. Good night. God bless and have a great week. So
we saw him go, of a preview, no word we know of him, my home. Shame my head. A fiery blade engaged to lead, he'd break the bravest in the
to his last emergency. It is, and all the other souls rested. You are rest in peace.
Love you and we miss you.